it is important to protect the techs.
What do you say to techs who are worried that caps are going to replace them?
But even if you look at the literature, it says we should be hooking up everybody who's altered. So if you started to expand this to the full spectrum, there's just more volume than techs could possibly do. What you really want the techs for are for the epilepsy patients and for patients who you literally need to know for certain where their seizures are coming from.
Dr. Coles, what is the primary purpose for EEG in the ICU?
So I think for us, at least, you know, in the neuro ICU, I think we use it as an extension of our exam. You know, it really gives you an extra insight into what the state of the brain is after injury or in somebody who's unconscious and comatose. And when they're not interacting with you, then you can't really assess where or how much injury there is and whether things are improving or worsening over time. And so EEG gives you insight into that. In other units, in this cardiac unit, we're mostly looking at, you know, how injured is the brain as a result of their cardiac event, their cardiac arrest or their MI or whatever. And so, you know, we can use it there to prognosticate or to assess severity of injury in those settings. And in other settings throughout the hospital, I think it's been important to look for folks with who might be having non-convulsive seizures who are altered. So I think it's been used, you know, differently in different areas of the hospital, but broadly to assess mental status.
So you had mentioned kind of the state of patients when they are presented to the ICU. Is there a specific clear-cut identifier of a patient that actually needs long-term EEG hookup? And are there any differing opinions on that between neurologists, physicians, epileptologists, where a patient may come in and one neurologist would say this patient needs a long-term EEG versus another neurologist that might say this patient doesn't? Do you see very much, contention there where two neurologists might disagree on what a indicator for an LTM is, or is it pretty straightforward?
I think most of us are fairly similar in our practice. I don't know that everybody gets to EEG first or as early as you might expect. But, you know, there's certainly populations. So people who come in with clinical seizure events and then don't recover consciousness, I think that's universally, it's part of the guidelines. You know, it's written into AES that if you can't know that somebody's fully recovered back to baseline, then you should hook them up to EEG. And they have, you know, something 20-30% of folks are still seizing when you do that. So there's I think universally everybody would say we need to do that. And it's driving some of this point of care stuff in the EDs, you know, around the country. There are, I think some of these ICU cases, I don't know that everybody thinks of EEG, and you see that because it's not widely available, right? So if you're a community neurologist, you don't use EEG that way because it's not something that's easily available. You don't have the equipment to go hook it up on a hospitalized patient. It's back in your clinic where you're doing outpatient routines. And so I think, you know, until you can build a need or a value proposition for smaller community hospitals to have inpatient EEG, it's a difficult. So not everybody uses it the same.
For hospitals that, let's say, they just invested in the EEG system, and some hospitalists that are rounding in the ICU, they're not necessarily aware or even used to ordering EEGs. Let's say they've been in that hospital system for the last 5 years, and really EEG is new. Do you anticipate that it would take some education for the staff in the ICU to get used to EEG? Or is this something that if they have it, they'll immediately know the use and how to order it, et cetera? What do you think about that?
That's a great question. So it was a question that's so good, we actually did it ourselves. So we, I took equipment over and stuck it in our community hospital and started a service over there. This is all published, so you're welcome to take a look at that. And what we discovered is adoption is slower, much slower than it was at the academic center. But there was clear adoption. And that's interesting because all the people rounding in the ICU over there are actually MICU faculty from the main hospital. So they were already aware. So if you were to go to really a truly naive center that's never had EEG, it would be even worse. We looked at over a 3-year period and only had about 90 studies done. That the hospital keeps cardiac arrest, so they weren't monitoring their cardiac arrest patients, which is challenging. And so that was one of their biggest excitement about, or their biggest selling points for having it, was that now they could do the same level of care that they could do at the other hospital when they were rounding over at this community hospital, you know. And so they saw that care equivalence within the cardiac arrest population as being really important. And the rest of the utilization was totally driven by the neurologists. And so we had some neurologists that were very familiar with the EEG in hospitals and some that were not. They were community hospitals or community neurologists that were doing mostly outpatient clinic and then would cover a week here or there. And so those outpatient guys weren't thinking about EEG at all. And so we definitely saw ups and downs in utilization. And we only had one machine, and that was plenty. So I would definitely not recommend buying six pieces of equipment as a starting point. You know, you want to ramp this up over time. But, you know, I think where we really started to get traction was when we started to find people in status. And that was very surprising to the hospitalists on the floor. And then we would move those patients into the ICU where the monitoring could be done continuously. I think that's probably one of the most important discoveries, you know, in my career time, right? So going back to the early 90s, when Ken Jordan started looking at hooking up EEG in hospitalized patients and discovered that not an insignificant number of them were actually in non-convulsive status. And that was part of the reason why they were altered. And so this exploded into a number of studies, you know, using both routine and prolonged EEG recording and showing that, you know, up to 20% of folks who are altered are actually having non-convulsive seizures. And to your question of, you know, how do you know who picks? Some of our epilepsy folks did a study on this looking at, are there any clinical features? And it was really HIPPS or pupillary variation in size or forced eye deviation were really the only things that were greater than coin toss associated with underlying seizures. Really, there was nothing else. So you really can't use your clinical exam alone other than alterations in mental status as your primary criteria. So that's why I say it's not something that everybody gets to early as you maybe would like. But they do the rest of their workup and their exam and their review of the cases. And then, you know, eventually when they can't find any other cause, they get around to EEG, most of them.
We've talked about under-ordering. Is there such thing as over-ordering?
Yeah. It depends on how you set up your system. So it was myself and one other faculty who covered that community hospital for 3 years. So with just two of us, and we didn't have a tech, so we used templates. And he and I were the only two that would go over and hook all these patients up. So
you were hooking the EEGs up.
Yeah, we hooked up the EEGs ourselves. So, you know, we demonstrated several things with that, that A, you didn't need to be a tech to use the templates and to get patients on recording, that the recordings were good. They were stable. We actually demonstrated that you could bill critical care time for doing that, for hooking patients up and assessing the patients. And get paid for that. So it was a new source of revenue for clinicians if they were going to hook patients up. And then we showed that we could effectively manage patients that we found in status, but it was a limited resource. So what I did at the community hospital was write a set of guidelines around the use. And we restricted it to the ICU because spell characterization on the floor is its own special thing. And this hospital served as the primary hospital for one of our local prisons. And so folks would come with, you know, a episode of syncope or something and be on the floor of the hospital for cardiac syncope workup. But if you put them on EEG, you know, then sometimes those folks will tear electrodes off. And it was impossible for us to maintain recording quality on the floor. Nursing was uncomfortable with the video. So there was a lot of education around when the video was reviewed. And so it was just a bigger to do. So we sort of, restricted, our ordering to altered mental status in the ICU as our primary use case. And then we set parameters around, emergent ordering, like who should get hooked up like immediately versus, who we could wait on later. So cardiac arrest, while it seems urgent, probably could wait till 7 a.m. the next day, you know, versus somebody who just had clinical seizures that didn't stop, and now are still altered, that person probably needs to be hooked up right away. So, you know, by using those sort of furnished guidelines, we sent those out to all the hospitalists, had those on site, provided them to the local tech, the one tech that was there doing outpatient stuff, so that if she got called for an emergent hookup or something during the day, she would know whether it was within guideline. And that was very helpful in sort of mitigating that.
You know, I'm a registered tech. That's music to my ears, because whenever you have over ordering, you burn out your staff. When you have under ordering, it is less patient care.
Yeah, I think it worked really well for the early days. You know, eventually that site was incorporated into our overall three hospital system, and all three have continuous EEGs and tech coverage now. But you know, it is important to protect the techs. You know, one of the things we really focused on early. So I started our ICU EEG program at Duke. And one of the things that was an early on issue was hooking people up and then taking them off for imaging and then hooking them back on again. And it's like, either you need to know structure or you need to know function, but you don't need to know structure in the middle of assessing function, mm-hmm. you know? And so, that was an early, you know, practice, effort on my part to try to get us to not hook up and disconnect and hook up and disconnect, patients. And so, you know, I think little things like that are important in terms of not burning out your techs, especially if you're going to have them on call. We also, at that same time, for the same reasons, we looked at using templates to replace call. So could somebody in-house already at the bedside hook this patient up to get the answer to whether they need to emergently be loaded with drugs and start managing their status? And then we can have the tech come in and convert that to, you know, a proper collodion-based system in the morning. You know, versus calling in a tech at 2 a.m. or something to hook somebody up. And we showed that, you know, incorporating these templates actually reduced costs for the service line. It made practical sense. It was in parallel to the community study. We showed you could, you know, basically generate some revenue around it for people who were at the bedside. And that's, so all that stuff's kind of out there, you know, and I think it's still waiting to sort of be adopted and brought in. I think one of the limiting factors is on the back end, the interpretation and reading. And so that's something that I think, you know, now that there's reader pools and things like that, yeah. that's going to be, you know, a better opportunity for sites to bring on the front end at relatively low cost, as long as they can contract for the back end.
Yeah. You had mentioned such things as caps and things that will actually help at 3 a.m. for a tech not to be called in or whatever. That is a contentious topic in the tech community, because they think if there's a cap or anything that's going to replace actually the 1020 system being put on by a technologist, that their jobs are in jeopardy. I have the opposite view of that, where I think, you know, I've even have a real world experience where I had my daughter's birthday and it was 7 p.m. and I got called in for a patient that was shivering. So I hooked the patient up. I realized it wasn't status, or they realized it wasn't status. And then I went home and I missed an hour and a half of my daughter's birthday. So, you know, that is how I approach it. What do you say to techs who are worried that caps are going to replace them and their job is no longer going to be valuable?
I don't think that's a concern. I'm in your camp on that. You know, I think, you know, there are, if you were to envision the full use, the full deployment of hospital-based EEG, and you were going to use this as a brain monitor in units like mine, where we have primarily brain-injured patients in our unit. But even if you look at the literature, it says we should be hooking up everybody who's altered, right? So if you started to expand this to the full spectrum, there's just more volume than techs could possibly do. And what you really want the techs for are for the epilepsy patients and for patients who you literally need to know for certain where their seizures are coming from. And so, you know, if you go back to the, you know, the localization in the 1020 system and the requirements for techs to be certified, you know, it's the precision of the placement, but that's totally not necessary for screening people for seizures or assessing their overall brain function. So I think the CAPS provide, you know, a respite. It allows us to expand our utilization of the technology to a larger population, and then selecting those that are having events that need to be more closely monitored over time. Their skin needs to be monitored, all the other things that techs do to protect patients and to enhance the quality of the study, bring them in for those patients. But for the other 80% that aren't seizing, it's just not necessary. And they only need to be on for 24 hours.
So I totally agree with you. And I think the consideration in this argument is that is understanding that this is a growing industry. It's a growing need. EEGs, immediate EEGs is a growing need. With you couple that with the fact that there's not enough technologists as there is, and there's a declining number, we're going to work on getting, you know, more and more technologists in the field. But there's the matter of fact is there is a declining number of technologists. And so with a growing need and a declining number of technologists, the caps, there's really no way that this is going to replace the tech, especially whenever, like you said, emergent screening needs, when the cap actually goes on the patient, and then we realize, or the physicians realize, that the patient actually needs a long-term 72-hour EEG, the tech is going to be the one going in there, gluing the electrodes down, making sure that there's a good connection, and maintaining that connection throughout the 72 hours. So techs have never been positioned so well, in my opinion. I hear complaints all the time on Facebook groups and LinkedIn, you know, that techs are being called in at 3 o'clock in the morning, 7 p.m., missing their daughter's birthdays. And I really think these screening, tools are essential, and there's a there's a need for them to alleviate being called in too much, which is what a tech actually wants. They want quality of life while they're on call, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, trying to get EEG down to normal business hours is the goal, right?
Right.
With these technologies. So, you know, use people that are already in the building to answer these questions up front, and bridge your time to when, you know, when people show up to their normal job, you know, as opposed to calling in people in the middle of the night. I mean, nobody really you know, wants to be called in from home, you know, in the middle of the night to do something. And then especially, you know, even in a selected population, I think a lot of us are selecting patients to, you know, the main driving force behind EEG in the hospital is detection of seizures, even though it can be used for a whole broad a variety of other assessments. But, you know, its main focus is finding people who need to be treated. And so, you know, I think, finding those patients first and then involving the techs makes a lot of sense, because there's, you know, like I said, 80% of our studies are going to not need them.
These screening tools, are they all similar? You know, I've heard of caps. You've heard of the hat band that goes around for specific patients. What's the difference between these tools?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've also spent, you know, over a decade looking at these things. Back when we first started in the early 2000s, there was really only one on the market. And so we started with that, and we asked, you know, if I trained a nurse practitioner or an APP, to hook this up, would the EEG I obtained with that be the same quality as a tech applied lead set? And we showed that indeed it was, that we could record pretty easily. What was funny is, you know, because of, HIV, the use of subdermal needles had kind of fallen out of favor, in the EEG world. And so the sort of resurgence of disposable electrodes kind of came on the scene, because people were sick of cleaning these gold plated electrodes, and they were expensive, and you had to have some place to store them. And so you know, we sort of our APPs were like, yeah, I'm not going to use needles, until they used them, and then they're like, wow, these are super easy and fast, you know. And they don't need any scalp prep or anything like that. And in the ICU, it turned out that those were really a fantastic technology, and were rapidly adopted by our group, and they last for days. So it was really we learned a lot from looking at that technology early on. Now there are a variety of different types of templates and things you can use. Not all of it's designed for point of care, like in the ED, but we've played with a lot of it in the ICU, and surprisingly, a lot of it is not working well. There, we haven't published on all this yet, but, you know, we've not found great, results with some of these rapid applications in the ICU. And I think the problem is a lot of them use, contact electrodes and non-Glodian, non-prep electrodes. And, when somebody's been in the ICU sick with fever, sweating, their head is a giant salt bridge. And so some of these contact technologies just don't work well. You just don't get good quality recording. So I think it fails there, but there's still this important role of upfront screening that you're mentioning. You know, when people come in, they've had maybe a witness seizure at home, another one by EMS coming in, they got a dose of Versed, and now they're not waking up, and you don't know whether they're still seizing or not. Those are people that definitely need to be screened. And I think, we looked at this many years ago.
Yeah.
It was one of the first papers I wrote at Duke, looking at, whether or not you could record from the hairline. You know, it's terrible to have to go dig around in the hair and prep the scalp and stick electrodes in. And as a resident, you just want to, you know, stick something on the sides of their head and, right, and get a reading. And so we sort of modeled, what hairline EEG would, using sort of a hat band, derivation from previously recorded data, and mixed up 120 different patterns that you see in EEG in hospitalized patients, and then looked at the sensitivity and specificity of those, and found that unfortunately, hairline EEG only detects about 70% of seizures. Even generalized seizures get missed using that approach. And so we kind of concluded that since there were other technologies that provide a full 1020 and take about the same amount of time to put on, and if you're going to use it for a number of hours to bridge to when the tech comes in and hooks that patient up, you know, you needed to use
a full
1020. Yeah. There was no reason to do less than that.
So for those who are listening, who aren't familiar with EEG, a 1020 system is basically the full head hookup where there's electrodes placed on pretty much all around the scalp. And hat band is just electrodes that are going around the hairline, as Dr. Coles had said. And so I imagine that there's limitations, like you said, with the just the number of electrodes going around, and not to mention focal abnormalities that might be happening that the hairline product can't really capture. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's been borne out over and over again in the literature. You know, I mean, there was a little controversy. We sort of published our thing back in 2011, and somebody, you know, wrote a rebuttal and said, you know, this is crazy, you should be able to do this. And then there were a couple papers where people used only seizure cases and showed that they could find them all if they added a central lead. But ultimately, over the subsequent years, there's been two or three really good studies, including a prospective trial of hairline recording with a device that all basically shows the same percentage. It's about 60 to 70% of seizures are detected that way, which is better than nothing. So certainly that's good.
What's the implications of missing the 30%, the 40%?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? I mean, if you miss 30% of seizures, we know that the longer somebody seizes, the harder it is to control and the more likely they are to have brain injury related to those seizures. It's difficult, you know, there's a lot of controversy around that, whether or not these non-convulsive seizures are causing brain injury. But I think, you know, Paul Vespa did a nice study in traumatic brain injury patients a number of years ago showing that those with seizures had higher intracranial pressures. So it caused increased blood flow and high ICP in this at-risk population. And then he also did sampled spinal fluid or fluid from around brain cells and showed that it caused injury. So it was causing a reduction in availability of metabolic or increased metabolic demand, which led to increase in markers of brain injury. So, you know, it does seem that these non-convulsive seizures can contribute, particularly in an injured brain, to secondary injury.
With all that being said, it really comes down to why would you want to miss 40% of the seizures in the ICU, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Regardless of what the data says or what people's speculation is, you want to be able to catch that 40% of seizures in the ICU. It almost seems a little bit careless, if I might say, to just assume that 40% is not worth catching. If you have products that are on the market that are similar to the hairline, and you can actually capture the full extent of what the brain is actually putting out, I would assume that, and I always think about it like this, if my family member is in the ICU and there's a potential that they could be in subclinical status, and there's two options. There's a hairline product, and then there's the full 1020, which is, again, all the electrodes on top of the scalp, and that can actually analyze the entire brain. My hope is that my family member gets that full the electrode hookup on the brain, so they know exactly what is going on, at least until the tech can actually come back and hook up that EEG.
Yeah, I agree. I think if there were a lack of options, or, you know, if it took, you know, six times as long to do the whole thing as it does to put the hairline stuff on, you know, then there'd be an, you could make an argument for at least screening with the hairline up front and maybe filling in the gaps later. But it really is not a huge difference in time or effort. And, you know, I think also, you know, in fairness, there was, when we used to have only a few anticonvulsants to load, they all came with risks. You know, valproate has some hepatic side effects, and antiplatelet effects. Dilantin had cardiac effects and blood pressure effects. So, you know, there were downsides to loading people unnecessarily on medications. And then once you load them, if you don't find seizures, you don't know if it's safe to stop. So it was hard. There's hard to know the endpoint if you load people up front unnecessarily. But with newer agents like Keppra and that are less likely to cause side effects, the risk for over-treatment, I think, is essentially zero. Like the, you know, so loading somebody on something out of suspicion is probably a better approach than not loading them at all and waiting 10 hours to find out that they're in non-convulsive seizures or non-convulsive status. So I think, you know, that was sort of part of the reason why people were sort of looking at these rapid screens, was to prevent over-treatment. And when you present it that way, then the numbers look really great. But it's because you're ignoring the 30% of people seizing that you're missing.
Exactly.
Because you're making decisions not to treat based on a negative outcome, which has a high, you know, predictive probability. So if your negative predictive value is super high, then if you don't see seizures, you're golden.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's been sort of the premise for some of these technology developments.
Yeah. Yes. I like to play a little game where it's a hypothetical case study, right? So we go down a whole scenario of a patient that's actually in the ICU or is experiencing epilepsy symptoms or whatever. So in this hypothetical scenario, what I want to do is talk about, let's say a patient comes in, has been screened by a product at 3 a.m. A tech actually hooks up the EEG with collodion and all that, the long-term EEG hookup at 8 a.m., let's say. The patient has been going in and out, maybe some intermittent epileptiform discharges, might have a higher risk of going into status or go, you know, having prolonged seizure activity. The LTM is hooked up. What are the risks of not checking in on this EEG frequently? So, you know, again, going to this scenario, someone is able to go in and look at the EEG every 4 hours, every 8 hours, et cetera. What are some of the risks of that? Is it okay to, let's say the tech hooks the patient up, the doctor looks at the EEG, signs off, 1 minute later, the patient starts seizing, maybe goes into status for 4 hours until the neurologist can actually log back on and look at the EEG. What's going on in that 4 hours for the patient as far as risk?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. I think this varies, you know, from place to place in terms of how we manage that. You know, there's been a lot of research looking at, are there predictors of patients who are most likely to have seizures and those that are unlikely to have seizures. So our group at Duke has done this and, you know, shown that if there's nothing epileptiform in the first 4 hours, that there's a less than 1% chance they're going to have a seizure sometime later. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a help in resource allocation. You know,
is that the two helps to be score?
Well, then there's that. Yeah, that work has been done. That didn't come from us, but that was a contributing data element to that. And so, you know, that is, you know, certainly, some of that effort to sort of look at the background and whether or not there's evidence for like periodic discharges or something that would make you, worried that this patient's going to have a high likelihood of having some kind of seizure at some point. And you might watch those more frequently. And so, you know, we have the luxury of having fellows who are training and are looking at these studies. That's kind of their full-time gig during the day. And then at night, they're cycling through all of the patients that are on. So it might be 2 or 3 hours between reviews.
That takes a lot of manpower.
That's a lot of manpower.
Right?
Yeah.
That in most hospitals I come across, they don't have that luxury. So the hospitals that actually aren't able to check in on these EEGs frequently, I guess that is who I'm really kind of aimed at that question is there a risk for a patient to, you know, status epilepticus, which status epilepticus for those who aren't familiar with epilepsy terminology, that means just you're seizing constantly, your brain is continuously seizing. And so let's say that the patient's continuously seizing for 4 hours. What are the implications there? What are the risks there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I mentioned, the VESPA study, there's some concern for secondary brain injury in those settings. But, you know, I think you have to always balance the practical aspects of not having any monitoring versus getting something.
Right.
And I mean, when we started EEG monitoring at Duke, it was the techs at the end of the day when they're done with their outpatient stuff, hooking up whoever we needed put on in the afternoon, and then it would run overnight, and then we would read it the next morning, right? And that's kind of what you're talking about. You discover, oh my gosh, this person's had, you know, 12 seizures overnight. Maybe we should treat those, you know? So we had to start somewhere. And so I think it's great if you can look at it continuously and somebody's dedicated. But in those settings, you know, if you have a local neurologist who's providing that service, I think, you know, when we were covering our community hospital, just me and one other person, you know, we would sort of rock, scissors, paper, shoot, who's on today, you know, who wants to read this.
Right.
And so, you know, you would look at it in the first 30 minutes and see what it looks like, but then check in a couple hours later, and then you kind of make a clinical judgment. You know, I would read it again at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And if I had concerns, I might wake up at 2 and check it again. But if it was, you know, what we call boring EEG, it was just a diffusely slow, nothing exciting. No, I'm not really worried. Then, you know, I might not look at it again until 8 a.m. And so I think there are those sort of practical choices in folks that are experienced in reading this that you can make that determination and apply some of those techniques. But, you know, having somebody look at it all the time is obviously the best.
Is ideal.
It's just not, you know, not something that's going to be practically available. I think doing some is better than doing nothing, for sure. To start screening patients, I think you can reduce your burden by setting up some guidelines for use and highlighting and identifying high risk at risk patients, so that your volumes aren't overwhelming. And then, you know, I think there's going to be a role for some of these new software things for detecting epileptiform activity and sending triggers. I know Dave Freeman down at Mayo in Jacksonville has been one of the, you know, big proponents of using Persist to trigger, and he has all that stuff sent to his phone, so then he can go in and review. And so there are ways of using technology to give you notifications that something's happened and you should go look at the EEG right away. So I think you can bridge some of those gaps, you know, using these tools. They're not perfect. They have to be kind of tweaked for each patient's seizures. But once you do that, you know, you can use it to manage and follow along how well or how effective the interventions are on stopping seizures in people who are in status and for picking up seizures in folks that might happen afterward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, maybe that 24/7 eyes on screen with the AI tools, whether eyes on screen is a tech or a doctor, obviously it makes economical sense for a tech to actually do it. And then alerting the neurologist in between those times of coming on and off and looking at the EEG or not. Seems like that's the ideal standard care, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think the role for some of these automated systems, even if you have a tech that's in front of the physician, is to allow scale. Right? Like the tech can only look at so many things at a time simultaneously. So if you're going to use somebody who's an expert like that, you want to use them on the studies that most need monitoring. And I think we can start to use some of this technology to filter out, you know, studies that need human review from those right. That don't. And I think that's probably where things are headed here.
Again, because EEG use is trending upwards and very fast. And we need more technologists. We just simply put, we need more neurologists, simply put.
Yeah. And I even see, you know, I started our telestroke program. And so I think telemedicine with COVID particularly kind of exploded. And I can see, you know, having a tech oversee people on the ground, hooking people up, right? So using a tech's expertise to its maximum potential, right, by putting them in the driver's seat and not necessarily at the bedside, I think is also going to be an opportunity for a shift in how we leverage that knowledge base and that expertise, you know, not only just in reviewing studies first, but make sure the quality of the recordings are good so that if these CAP systems are being used, you might be able to staff 26 hospitals, right, with one tech across the entire country, as opposed to one small region, you know, where then they have to drive out and, you know, go to each facility. Why not, you know, work with the person at the bedside to get the right thing done now urgently. And then we'll come in and those patients that are seizing that are going to need this for, you know, another 24 to 48 hours to get
the tech
under control,
is there to
get that done properly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.